Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. California is well known for its deep blue political tilt, but this November, the Golden State is providing opportunities for Republicans to potentially win their first statewide race in more than a decade and possibly determine the balance of power in Congress. The party is hoping to tap into Californians' concerns and frustrations over soaring inflation, crime, and homelessness, and to turn that discontent into votes. But Democrats in the state have utilized the Supreme Court's ruling on abortion to energize their base in the hopes of flipping a handful of congressional seats that they lost in 2018. To get a better understanding on their party strategy and focus with less than a month until Election Day, we've invited Jessica Milan Patterson, chairwoman of the California Republican Party, back onto the program. Chairwoman Patterson, welcome back to Insight.
Hey, Vicky, thanks for having me.
So you were recently on Fox 40 here in Sacramento, and you said that you were confident that conservatives can make inroads this midterm. I want to focus on those inroads. What is your party's priorities and focus between today and Election Day?
Well, it's turning out the vote. You know, we've done a lot of work over the last 2 years to persuade people. And in this last month, we're going to be focused on taking all of those people that we've persuaded and turning them out. The quicker we get ballots in, the quicker we are able to move on to other universes and build out the types of wins that we could have here in California.
Yeah, earlier, when you joined us at the beginning of the year on Insight, and you've said this since, that you're working to bring that message to communities that have never really heard it before. What communities specifically are you trying to connect with?
Yes, thank you. This is one of my favorite questions that I get, and we couldn't have done it without the partnership on the national level. I truly believe that our chairwoman at the national level, Ronna McDaniel, has been an absolute transformative partner in all of this. We've opened community centers throughout our state and throughout the country that focuses on these communities that have been neglected by our party over the years. So in Orange County and Little Saigon, we opened up a community center that focused on Asian populations. In Congressman Mike Garcia's district and Congressman David Valadeo's districts in Palmdale and Bakersfield, respectively, we opened up community centers that focused on the Latino communities. And these aren't the typical types of headquarters where you just launch precinct walks and do phone bank. We do that too. But it's a place where you can get English help. It's a place where you can get legal help. In our headquarters in Little Saigon, we have a Vietnamese dance team that practices there on Saturdays. Nationwide, we've developed our Republican Civics Initiative, which has staff that is trained by the State Department to help people work through and study for their citizenship tests. So these are things that we're doing on the national level, on the state level, and specific communities here in California to help talk about the issues that are most important to people. When I was first elected, one of our now candidates for Congress, John Duarte, invited me to come to his farm and talk to his farm workers about the issues that were important to you, to them. And I can tell you what those issues were. They wanted to make sure they had a good job so that they could provide for their families. They wanted to make sure that their kids were getting a great education so they could be better than their generation. And they wanted to make sure that their streets were safe. And California Democrats have quite frankly failed them on all of those levels. So being able to show up, listen, talk to them about what we would do as Republicans, whether it's the commitment to America that the national congressional candidates have pushed or the promise with California that our state legislative leaders have pushed. We are focused on the issues that are most important to Californians.
Well, given, and I know that you're well aware of this, that registered Democrats in the state outnumber Republicans nearly 2-1, and the number of no party preference has grown in recent years and rivals registered Republican voters. Given that voting is now already underway in California, ballots have begun landing in mailboxes this week. What is the California GOP doing to connect with voters in a state where the cards are stacked against your party?
Yeah, so we've seen great growth over the last several years. And, you know, in fact, when I took over as chair, we were the third largest party behind Declined Estates, and we have overtaken Declined Estates. Right now, we've gone from 42,000 volunteers at the end of our 2020 election cycle to over 74,000 volunteers. So the excitement and the momentum is definitely there. And, you know, now it's about the resources and deploying those resources to talk to voters, to if they haven't already made a decision, help them make that decision, get those ballots in. We do that through phones. We do that through digital. We do that through knocking on doors. And we're going to continue to do that all the way through when polls close on Election Day.
Given that Republicans haven't won a statewide office in 2006, what specific races, and we don't even have to focus entirely on statewide, there's congressional as well. What specific races does your party have the most confidence?
So I think that there's been a huge focus this cycle on growing our congressional delegation. You know, we were responsible for sending more new Republicans to the House of Representatives than any other state in the country. Big Blue California sent more new Republicans to the House. And so after redistricting, we saw a lot of opportunities. And through the great recruitment that House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy has done, even seats that weren't on that initial target list are now coming to a place where, oh my gosh, we might be able to win a few more. We've even seen just yesterday, Speaker Pelosi has pulled back money from the House Majority PAC in three races here in California. Congressman Mike Garcia's, Congresswoman Young Kim's, Congresswoman Michelle Park Steele. And, you know, it's because she has to go and play defense in places that she otherwise thought were safe. And then statewide, I think you've got a great contrast when it comes to our statewide candidates, whether it's Brian Daly, the farmer and businessman at the top of the ticket running against Gavin Newsom, who has failed the state on so many different levels. Or you look at someone like Nathan Hochman, who is clearly coming down on the side of victims and citizens and not criminals, unlike someone like Rob Bonta, who has championed soft on crime policies here in California. Or someone like Lonnie Chen, who is committed to being the taxpayer's watchdog and not someone who is going to collaborate with people that she is supposed to have oversight on, like Maria Cohen.
When you last spoke with us, you had said that the GOP had an opportunity to make sure that the Speaker of the House isn't just from California, but a Republican from California. And we're talking about Congressman Kevin McCarthy, who is considered by many to be that Californian if Republicans win enough seats in the House next month. What conversations have you had with Congressman McCarthy about the midterm election?
We talk about all of the opportunities, and, you know, there is no greater partner to the California Republican Party than House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy. And so, you know, we talk as often as possible, and it's about, you know, the new excitement that we're seeing on the ground. It's in the tough races where we're going to have to spend more money and make sure that we're turning out our vote. You know, all of these races are, you know, within that margin of error. And so making sure that we spend the resources and also we're not taking anything for granted. Just because the Speaker Pelosi has stopped spending money in some of these races, it doesn't mean that it's a cakewalk. We still have to push all the way through to November.
Abortion has become a key issue nationally this midterm following the Supreme Court decision. I understand California is investing more protections for reproductive rights in response, but just a simple, straightforward question. Does the California GOP have an official stance on the right to abortion?
Yeah, so we're a pro-life party. And, you know, even if Prop 1 were to fail, nothing would change here in California. The Dobbs decision gave the rights back to the states to make decisions. And here in California, those protections will not change, even if Prop 1 fails.
Do you view that as a challenge, given that polling shows the general public overwhelmingly, or the majority of the general public, supports a right to choose and supports reproductive rights when you're running for races in Congress and statewide races and even local?
I think that each one of these candidates, and we've seen it, we have multiple pro-choice candidates. They are authentic to what their positions are. And I've been always tried to be the type of leader that, you know, respects and wants to have a big tent within our party. While my views may be incredibly conservative, you know, we have people like Lonnie Chen, Nathan Hochman, Matt Gunderson, who are all pro-choice candidates here in California that are also Republicans. You don't see that type of diversity on the Democrat side.
What are the main challenges that your party faces that you as chairwoman are working to overcome?
I think being absent from many communities around the state, offering those viable alternatives. And I think that we have done a really good job of talking to people about issues that are important to them, but also showing up, showing up and having those tough conversations. And, you know, we've seen time and time again, many of these communities are not living their best lives because Democrats have put into place policies that are going to help them. And in fact, by most metrics, it would say the exact opposite. But Democrats have shown up and Democrats have made them feel like they care about their problems. And so that has certainly been a challenge, but I think it's a challenge that we were up to the task of taking on, and we will continue to focus on over the next coming years.
Recently, in response, Republicans in the state rolled out the California Promise, and that identifies some of the key challenges facing the state: cost of living, public safety, homelessness, among them. These are familiar issues your party has campaigned on in previous elections, but the California Promise is based on broad themes. I mean, it's seemingly few specific. Can you, as chairwoman with the California GOP, give us some specifics as to how Republicans will tackle these really deep-rooted, nuanced, layered issues such as inflation, such as homelessness, crime, safety, water, et cetera?
Yeah. So when we're talking about inflation, you know, we're hit hard here because of policies that have been enacted by Democrats in California. So when we talk about the high prices of gas, you know, we have the highest gas tax in the nation. California Republicans have asked for a gas tax holiday. That would immediately bring down costs for California consumers. When we talk about our education system, we've seen what has happened in our public schools. When 50% of our children are not reading at grade level, and less than a third are at grade level when it comes to math and science, we have failed our children. And so giving parents a voice, giving parents choices, these are all things that we think will lead to better results for our students. When we talk about wildfire prevention, it is not enough to say what we are going to do. We have to do what we are going to do. And the fact of the matter is that this governor has come forward with so many lofty goals and has not committed to getting them done, and has in fact lied about what has been done. So making sure that there isn't fuel for these fires to burn. And, you know, this particular year, we've had a very mild fire season. Had it not been such a mild fire season, we would see much more of our state likely up in flames right now. When we talk about water, we're the fifth largest economy in the world, and we're rationing water. We're watching lawns die. And, you know, just it's a very, very sad state of affairs, you know, fields going fallow. And we have not built the water storage that is necessary for times when we do have water coming. It all goes off into the ocean, despite the fact that voters have approved that water storage being done. So these are the types of specifics that California Republicans are committed to. And what was important about the California Promise is that we have one place to go where if you're voting for a Republican, this is what they are going to be focused on. And it's not enough to say that California Democrats have screwed up our state. I mean, it's like saying the sky is blue. It's very clear. Their policies, they've been in charge for the last decade, both houses of the legislature and the governor's seat. But what would you do as a Republican? And that's what our legislative leaders have put together with the California Promise.
Earlier this week, we had California Senator Alex Padilla on Insight, and we asked him what his message was to Californians who say they're facing serious financial hardships right now and are not feeling the effects of the Inflation Reduction Act, which he supported. We're going to listen to a part of what his response was and then allow you to respond to him.
I see it and feel it, not just as a U.S. senator. I feel it as a husband and as a father. Andrew and I are trying to raise three boys. So when we buy milk, when we buy meat, when we're filling the gas tank, we see it and we feel it as well. You know, the good news is, again, Democrats in Congress are taking action. I'm shocked, to be honest, that not a single Republican joined us in passing the Inflation Reduction Act that reduces healthcare costs, extends ACA premiums for those who rely on that for healthcare, capping the cost of prescription drugs. I mean, that impacts everybody, Democrats, Republicans, red states, blue states. Democrats found a way to deliver.
So this goes back to an argument that it's easy to point, criticize, and blame, but solutions are deep-rooted, and sometimes solutions can be few and far between. What is your response to Senator Padilla?
I don't think that he should be surprised when multiple nonpartisan analysis said that this quote unquote Inflation Reduction Act would do nothing to reduce inflation. And here we are, you know, a month after they celebrated on the White House lawn, as we watched the Dow take a nosedive because of those high inflation numbers that were being announced simultaneously while Democrats were partying on the South lawn. Again, we're here today, 8.2% year over year. This is not this should not surprise anybody. When we see 87,000 new IRS agents added to the current 80,000, we have already doubled. We have now doubled the amount of IRS agents. These are not people that are going after billionaires. Their answer to fixing the problems is going after the taxpayers. I don't know a single person that doesn't think they pay enough in taxes.
Given that people can really feel inflation and gas prices and the cost of living, you know, I'm curious what your thoughts are, given that Republican State Senator Brian Dawley, who's running against the governor, and there's just a few weeks left to the midterm, a UC Berkeley IGS poll found 53% of likely voters will back the governor, 32% support Dawley. Why do you think your party's candidate has so far fell short to resonate with the majority of likely voters this midterm?
Well, I think there's a huge resource gap, and that makes it difficult when you have 10 different media markets and, you know, a media that isn't necessarily reporting on, you know, all of the failures of this governor. And so I think that that is definitely a challenge. But listen, I think that it's going to be incredibly difficult whether you're running for governor or whether you're running for dog catcher to run with that D behind your name. Californians are not blind to who's been in charge and what's been happening to their state. And we've seen it. We've seen people leave our state for the first time in our state's history. We lost a congressional seat. We continue to see those voter registration numbers, the amount of eligible voters go down. And that's because California Democrats have failed our state.
Finally, your party has made the argument time and time again, the state's one-party rule is broken. That may resonate with a lot of voters, but regardless of what happens next month, the state legislature will likely continue to be controlled by Democrats. Where can your party find compromise in the spirit of achieving some of those promises that you've outlined?
Yeah, I think that, you know, Democrats are going to see in places where they didn't think that they necessarily have to fight, that it's going to be a lot tighter. And I think that that is going to help them to be more willing to work across the aisle with Republicans. Right now, not a single Democrat has to do that. So when they talk about, you know, going and working across the aisle, it's not because they have to. Right now, I think that they have the opportunity to bring real relief to Californians. And I think that they're going to see, whether it's the initiative, some of our statewide candidates, or some of these legislative districts, they're going to see that Republicans and, you know, non-traditional people, non-traditional Republicans are going to be voting for Republicans. And they have the opportunity to bring home some real relief to Californians. And it's going to take them stepping aside from their agenda and working to help their people and working with Republicans.
Chairwoman Patterson, thank you for the time.
Thanks, Vicki.
Jessica Milan Patterson is the chairwoman of the California Republican Party, sharing her party strategy and focus with the midterm just weeks away. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Pregnancy can be an exciting time, but it can also bring understandable stress because every pregnancy is different. There are big unknowns and discoveries along the way that are just out of our control. A variety of testing and screenings are available to give soon-to-be parents a clear picture of the baby's overall health and development. One screening is for spina bifida, which is an abnormal development of the spine that can carry lifelong disabilities, including paralysis. Up until now, parents have the option of treatment after birth to reduce spina bifida's defects, but it is far from a perfect solution. UC Davis Health discovered a completely novel approach that is a first in the world. It's a surgery using stem cell treatment, and that takes place while the fetus is still in the womb. The trial began last year, and this month was a historic milestone. UC Davis Health announced three babies have been born after undergoing this groundbreaking treatment. Leading the trial is Dr. Diana Farmer, chair of the Department of Surgery at UC Davis Health. Welcome to Insight, Dr. Farmer.
Hi, Vicki. Happy to be here.
So for those who don't know, what is spina bifida?
So spina bifida is a condition where the spinal cord and all those structures around it, the actual bony spine and the muscles and skin, fail to close. And so it leaves, that happens at about 6 weeks in gestation. And that leaves that vulnerable spinal cord tissue, that developing spinal cord, exposed to the environment, to the amniotic fluid, to rubbing up against the mom's uterus. You know, you can feel the baby kicking later. So that causes damage to that spinal cord as it's developing.
Historically, what solutions have been available for spina bifida?
Well, I myself am a fetal surgeon, so I've been involved in fetal surgery now for myself about 30 years. It actually started, the first fetal surgery was almost 40 years ago.
Wow.
So it's been around, but previously, fetal surgery was reserved only for those fetuses that were either going to have fetal demise, they didn't make it through gestation, or would die immediately after birth. So partly because, you know, the risk to the mom for fetal surgery is significant. It's a little, I think of it as like donating a kidney or something. A healthy person has an operation, but not for their benefit. For the benefit of someone else. In this case, it's the developing fetus. So in the early days, until we knew more about the safety of fetal surgery, we only did it for fatal fetal conditions. Spina bifida is not usually fatal, but it's pretty bad. These poor kids, you know, have problems with extra fluid on the brain. They can be paralyzed. They can't pee normally. They can't poop normally. And that lasts for life. So we started doing work on coming up, just ask the question, if we did this before birth and just did the same operation, protected, covered that developing spinal cord, could we make the outcomes better? And this was published. The answer was yes. So this was published about 11 years ago. I remember it because I was just applying for my job at UC Davis at the time, moving from San Francisco to Sacramento. And that was groundbreaking. That changed the standard of care. It definitely showed that if you had surgery before birth, it was better than after birth. And in addition to improving a lot that fluid on the brain problem, it also showed some improvement in the leg function, in the paralysis. Kids went from only 20% being able to walk if they had surgery after birth to 40%. Being able to walk if they had surgery before birth. So it's still good. But what I noticed was, well, heck, that means there's still 60% who can't walk. So, and that if we got some improvement, maybe we could get more, that there was plasticity. There was hope for that spinal cord. It wasn't just bam, fixed at 6 weeks gestation. So I started collaborating with spinal cord injury experts at San Francisco General and a bioengineer at Berkeley, and basically brought him with me to Davis. And we went back to the lab and spent the next 10 years researching new solutions.
And now we have the CURE trial, and that combines surgery with stem cells. What is the benefit of adding stem cells, and how is that different than what was previously conducted?
So it's really exciting, and we're super excited about stem cells. Stem cells were just kind of being discovered about 10 years ago. And frankly, all this work was supported by California taxpayers through the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine, CIRM, which is an unbelievable engine for scientific discovery and for bringing new business into California. So they have been wonderful supporting this work. And what we discovered was that placental-derived stem cells. So if you think about it, the placenta, in my mind, is just an amazing organ. It grows and then it goes away in 9 months. It does its job. It protects the fetus from being rejected. It makes giant blood vessels. I mean, it's the coolest thing ever. I think everyone should study the placenta. But and then it's just discarded. You know, every time a baby's born, the placenta is just thrown away. So we started looking at cells derived from the placenta. And it turned out they had extra special characteristics. They were different than the same kind of cells derived from bone marrow or adults. So we started working in the lab and engineered them in a special sort of neurogenic way. So they paid attention to neurons. And we discovered that in animal models and in dogs who have spina bifida, it made them better. If we applied those cells, those specially engineered cells, directly on the spinal cord. So we got approval through the FDA, and it's brand new. These placental stem cells have never been put in a fetus before or in the central nervous system.
How are they put on a fetus?
So these cells are attached to kind of a patch that's normally used, already approved, to close the dura, the protective lining around the brain and the spine. So we put those directly on the patch. Then we use the patch to close the dura, just like we would in an operation before birth or after birth, and then close the skin over that. So the only thing different from the regular fetal surgery operation is putting the cells on the patch.
Now that you've experienced some milestones this month by having successful births after the stem cell treatment, what did you learn from these pregnancies, from these first patients who took part in this trial?
Well, this is what's called a phase 1/2a trial. So the FDA is very cautious, as were we, to make sure that these cells were safe, right? That they didn't cause some strange abnormal growths, they didn't cause tumors. Because one of the advantages of some kinds of stem cells is that they're what's called pluripotent. You can turn them into different things. You can replace tissues. You can do lots of things. So these stem cells are a little different. They're more like mesenchymal stem cells, or different categories that these mostly focus on muscle and things like that. But they were from the placenta. So this was strange too. And they're put in a fetus, which is also, if you think about it, the fetus is one big regenerative thing, right? It's making new eyeballs and fingertips, right, and hair and all the time. So the FDA was pretty nervous. So what we learned from these first three patients is that there appear to be no safety concerns. We haven't seen anything unexpected. It hasn't interfered with the regular repair. And we had our first meeting of our safety monitoring board, our oversight board, who concluded the same thing and gave us permission to continue the trial.
How did it affect the development of the fetus by completing fetal surgery and using stem cells with that patch? How did development change? Hopefully for the better.
Yes. So we aren't going to know. So I think what you're asking are, what are the outcomes?
Yes.
You know, are the cells making the kids, you know, walk? Well, if you think about it, unlike sheep and dogs, kids don't walk till they're 2 years old anyway. So, and it's always hard to forget, which is part of why this disease is so frustrating, because all babies can't walk and they're incontinent and, you know, they have diapers. And so parents often don't realize that their child, if untreated, might always be in diapers and might always not be able to walk. And that's one of the reasons I think this is such a devastating and nasty disease, which is why I've wanted to do something to make it better.
And given that this trial is...
We're not going to know for about another couple of years what the real outcome is. But I can tell you that in our animal models, we had great results in outcome. So we're hoping we see that in the humans as well.
So with that, finally, what is next for the CURE trial? Because you're in the first stage and, you know, you're kind of in a waiting game when it comes to the babies that were just born.
So what's next is that when we finish the next three patients, although frankly, we're going to ask the FDA for early permission to treat patients at a faster pace because it has appeared to be so safe in our humans as well as in our animal models. So if we get that approval, we'll be able to treat another about 30 patients, hopefully over the next year or two.
Wow, that's significant. Dr. Farmer, thank you so much for explaining this. It's fascinating.
Well, thank you for having me.
Dr. Diana Farmer is the Chief of Department of Surgery at UC Davis Health, talking about conducting the world's first treatment for spina bifida using stem cells while the fetus is still in the womb. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Regardless how well we know our family history, the generations before us help shape who we are today, whether we know it or not. It is pretty cool tracing back family trees and learning about our ancestors. I think of the PBS show Finding Our Roots, but it is a great deal of work. I mean, there's a lot of curves, dead ends, as well as unexpected roads. Well, James Richardson was more than up for the task. The former senior writer with the Sacramento Bee and retired Episcopal priest spent the past 20 years, give or take, retracing the steps of his great-great-grandfather, George Richardson. Without giving too much away, we'll let Jim do that, but what he found was pretty powerful, but was also nearly at risk of becoming forgotten. The journey culminated in Jim's new book, The Abolitionist's Journal, Memories of an American Anti-Slavery Family. Jim joins us now. Nice to see you, Jim.
Thank you, Vicky, for having me. I much appreciate it.
I know. I'm happy we got our selfies out of the way in the studio.
Absolutely.
So you and your wife, Lori, spent more than 20 years on this project. Let's start from the beginning. What sparked this journey?
Well, there was in my father's study for my entire life, he had this big black notebook about couple inches thick, and it was always called the journal, but I never really knew what was in it. I knew it had something to do with one of our ancestors, and I had never read it. No one ever really talked about it. In the 1990s, I had been in journalism for a good 2 decades, and I had this epiphany to become an Episcopal priest, and I had gone through all the hoops in the church, and I had quit my job at the Sacramento Bee, and I was getting ready to go off to our seminary in Berkeley, and I took a month off, and then I began to think, what have I done? This is crazy. And I started trying to figure out how to get my job back at the Bee, And at that moment, my dad said, you really need to read this book. I've always thought he always knew me better than I knew myself. And so he gave me this book. I spent a weekend reading it. And what it turned out to be was this handwritten journal by my great-great-grandfather. His name was George Richardson. He was a Methodist itinerant preacher. And what I learned was he and his family, he had grown up in upstate New York. He had moved to the Midwest as a young man. But he and his family were just ardent abolitionists, ardently against slavery. Their religion was against slavery. He and his wife, Carolyn, used their house on the Underground Railroad. And then in the Civil War, he volunteered to be the white chaplain to a black Union regiment in Memphis. And in the Civil War, when the Union finally decided that black people could be in the army, the rule was that they had to have white officers. And he volunteered to join one of these regiments. After the war, he and his wife, Carolyn, founded a school for the previously enslaved and started in Dallas. They had three black pastor partners. This could not have happened without them. The Ku Klux Klan burned it down in Dallas. The black community rebuilt the school. And then the city of Dallas came up with a test for the teachers that they could not possibly pass. So then the city closed it down. And then it relocated in Austin. That school became Samuel Houston College in Austin. Samuel Houston, it's really spelled Huston, and he was a Iowa abolitionist. But that school is thriving today. It's now Houston Tillotson University in Austin. We've been to the school several times. But my wife, Lori, and I, in these last 20 years, we've been wandering around the country looking for things and finding, we found Carolyn, his wife's diary, on a stairwell in my aunt's house. And it was almost like Carolyn from the grave was saying, well, if you're going to tell my husband's story, you better get mine in too.
And you did. And This obviously led to a deeper understanding of your family roots. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's deeply personal. But you also talk about, you know, there are parallels to current day. And in the few minutes that we have left, what do you hope readers take away from your book?
Well, our stories matter. I know that's a cliche, but how we think of our ancestors matters. Slavery is the legacy of our country, the brutality of it, the ugliness of it. That's our legacy. But also our legacy are those who fought against it, who tried to do something about it. And when slavery ended, understood that was just the first step. And those, that's also our story. That's also who shapes us. But I also asked the question, how come we never talked about this in my family? It was almost like it was treated as an embarrassment. Why do we have this this white amnesia about these things. And I'm really trying to penetrate through that fog of what I think is an intentional, a deliberate not wanting to remember. Yeah. And I don't see how we really come to a place of racial equality and reconciliation and justice without first understanding these stories and understanding what we're really carrying around with us that shapes us. And that's the real point of the book.
I think that is a big question that resonates with a lot of people today. You know, finally, how can people get your book and learn about George Richardson and apply it to their own lives?
Well, you can buy it online. Right now, we've sold out of every copy in Sacramento.
That's a good problem.
But you can get it on whatever your online bookseller is. We're hoping there will be more books at Beers Books.
Off S Street in Sacramento.
Off S Street pretty soon, yeah. But we sold them out. And you can also get it from the publisher, which is the University of New Mexico Press. And It's a general interest imprint of that of UNMC called High Road Books. You can go to the University of New Mexico Press website and order your copy or wherever you like to buy your books.
Well, congratulations for that. I mean, that is amazing. How does that make you feel, given the response that you've received?
Well, first, a lot of relief. It's done. but the response so far has been very positive. And it's, to me, this is my second book. I wrote a book about Willie Brown a few years ago. And the fun part of writing a book, besides just getting it done, is getting to talk about it. You know, I think books have power because they start conversations. Mm-hmm. So we're just beginning what I hope is a good conversation around what's in this book. And hopefully it has some legs to it. But
yeah. It must have felt nice on, I believe, earlier this week on Monday, you had a talk with Ginger Rutland, who was also a former journalist as well. Yeah. And actually being able to see people take in all the work that you did, but also seeing how it resonates with what they're grappling with or with their own lives.
Well, Ginger and I have been friends for 30 years. We were both reporters at the Capitol and then later at the Bee. And Ginger's been hugely helpful throughout this project. She was very helpful with the Willie Brown book, too. So she's been a great colleague. And so having her asking me questions on Monday at Beers Books was great. And she knows the book very, very well and asks some very penetrating questions, which, of course, make me want to rewrite parts of the book. But that was really a lot of fun.
Well, it's been so well received. And so just congratulations on that work. And we do have a link to the publisher's page if people are interested in purchasing your book. Jim, so nice seeing you.
Thank you, Vicki. I much appreciate it.
Thank you for stopping by. Jim Richardson is a former senior writer with the Sacramento Bee and retired Episcopal priest, discussing his new book about his great-great-grandfather called The Abolitionist Journal, Memories of an American Anti-Slavery Family. We have a link to the book on our Insight page. We do have a programming note. We're ending Insight a few minutes early for the continuation of the January 6th hearings. With that, that is Insight for today. You can learn more about all of our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you want to join the conversation, email us, insight@capradio.org. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you back here on Monday.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.